Well, good morning, church. It's good to see you all this morning. Good to be with you all and worship with you today. You can go ahead and open up your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 2. We're going to be in 2 Kings chapter 2 virtually all of this morning, talking about a story that we find here. I'm looking out in the audience. I see some guests with us this morning. Thank you all for being here. We're certainly honored that you all are here worshiping God with us this morning. We hope that you'll follow along with us in our Bible study today. In 2 Kings chapter 2, there's a very interesting story that happens, and I want to spend our time talking about that story. And we're just going to read that story starting out, and I'll tell you why we're going to be talking about that afterwards. So 2 Kings chapter 2, starting in verse 23, just three verses at the end of the chapter. The text says, "He," that is Elisha, "went up there from Bethel, and while he was going up on the way, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him, saying, 'Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head.' And he turned around, and when he saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. And two she-bears came out of the woods and tore 42 of the boys. And from there he went to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria." That is a very interesting story. And I've often asked myself, why is that story in the Bible? There are a lot of stories that are difficult to deal with in the Bible, for me personally, and for a lot of Christians, and especially for a lot of skeptics, to believe the Bible. If the Bible is true, why are there stories like this in the Bible? What's the purpose? I was reading an article not too long ago that was written by a Bible skeptic, and I'm going to read a little excerpt of what he said in his article. It was written, like I said, by a skeptic, and he was calling out Bible believers, particularly those who preach the Bible. And so this hit home for me, what he had to say. He said that the Bible presents a capricious or cruel God who would destroy entire nations, who would kill babies, who would wipe out the whole world except for a handful of people, who would use animals to kill small children just for making fun of someone. If you Bible believers really believe the Bible, why don't you preach the bloody Bible? And I thought that was a really interesting point. If you really believe the Bible, why don't you preach the bloody Bible? And I thought, you know, he's right. He caught me. And so I think that I need to preach the bloody Bible every once in a while. There are some difficult stories to deal with in the Bible, and I don't think that we need to make a habit of dwelling on those stories, but we do need to understand them. I think I need to talk about that for a couple of reasons. First, because I need to have a reason to tell a skeptic why I believe in the Bible. I need to be able to talk to him about why these bears attack these children. I need to tell him why God struck down Nadab and Abihu for offering up strange fire. I need to tell them why God instituted holy war and wiping out nations, why he destroyed the world with a flood. I need to be able to tell him that and answer a skeptic. And while I'm not sure what I have to say would change a skeptic's mind, I need to be able to give a defense for my God. But I also need to talk about those things to help equip my people to understand these stories, for Christians to understand these stories, because these are hard stories to deal with. This story in 2 Kings, is there anyone in this room that this is their favorite story in the Bible? No. The favorite story in the Bible is not the bears coming to attack the children. We may tell the story to children whenever they're being disobedient to us. Did you know God used bears to destroy children once? We may use it in that context, but this isn't our favorite story. We don't like what this story implies sometimes, and especially how it's used by non-believers. It's a difficult thing to wrap our minds around. But the Bible says that all scripture is breathed out by God, and it's profitable for teaching and reproof and correction and training in righteousness so that we can be perfect. So this story is here for a reason. And I want to talk about it and get really the whole picture of why this story is here and what's really happening in this story. Because I don't think that this story is how it's often presented. And so with that in mind, I just have one thing that I want to request this morning before we get into the text. I know that there are a lot of Bible teachers in this audience, both of children and adults who have been teaching a lot longer than I have. I'm going to present some things in the story that maybe you have not heard before, and maybe you've even taught this story in a different way. And that's completely fine if you don't agree with the conclusions that I've come to. That's completely fine. But what happens sometimes in Bible study is we've heard something over and over and over and over, and that's the way that we think it is. And when we sit down and read it, we realize there's a little bit different things going on in this story than what I remember. So this morning, while we're going through this story, my request is just be open-minded, be open your eyes, and read the text, because we're going to look at the text, only the text, and see what the text has to say about this story and make sense of what's going on here in 2 Kings chapter 2. So before we jump into this story... Well, my PowerPoint is not working. How about that? We're just going to have to go along without the PowerPoint then, because I don't know why that's not working. Before we get into this story, we're going to have to establish a little bit of context here in the background, because the important thing to notice in this story is it's not a story in isolation. This story happens for a reason in here. So we need to back up to the beginning of the chapter in this story and realize what's going on here. So the first thing that we need to see is in chapter 2 in verse 1, at the very beginning of this chapter, 2 Kings chapter 2 in verse 1. It's really unfortunate that that's not working because I had some things that were there. What's that, Dan? Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, see if you can get that going for me. I appreciate that. 2 Kings chapter 2 in verse 1. What we have here is the story picks up with Elijah. Elijah is the prophet of God who has been the enemy of idolatry. If there was ever a prophet in the world that hated idolatry, it was Elijah. And he proved that over and over in all of his different stories about him, in his bout on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal, and how he called down the fire from the Lord to consume his sacrifice, and then he killed the 400 prophets of Baal with his own hand. He hated idolatry, and he was at war with the king of Israel, with Ahab, who was arguably the king of idolatry at that time. And he just hated idolatry. And the time has come now for Elijah to leave. He's ready to leave. So 2 Kings chapter 1, or chapter 2 and verse 1. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up into heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. So the Lord is getting ready to take Elijah up. He's going to take him away. And Elisha has been dubbed as the next prophet of God by God and by Elijah. So he goes with him. So in verse 2, Elijah says to Elisha, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." And so they went down to Bethel. So he says, "I'm leaving. You need to stay and wait." Elijah says that to Elisha. And Elisha says, "No, I'm going to come with you. I need to come with you." And then there's this interesting interaction that happens twice in the next few verses. We get introduced to the sons of the prophets, who, in my research and what I found, it seems to be a legitimate group of people who were training themselves to be speakers for God. They were training to be prophets of God. And so this group comes out of the city, and in verse 3, the sons of the prophets who were in Bethel, they came and they take Elisha aside, and they said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you?" And his response is really interesting. He says, "Yes, I know it. Keep quiet." Which, if I can paraphrase that, but what I think Elisha is saying is, "I know that. Back off." Now, of course I know that Elijah is leaving. Just drop it. Leave it there. And so then we continue with the story, and Elijah says to him again, "Elisha," in verse 4, "please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." And Elisha again says, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." And so they both go down to Jericho. And again, the sons of the prophets come out of Jericho, and they say to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take you away from your master, or your master from over you?" And he answers again, "Yes, I know it. Keep quiet. I know that's going to happen. Keep quiet." And so then Elijah asked him again, "Please stay here, for I've been sent to the Jordan." But he says, "No, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." And so the two of them go across to the Jordan River, and the sons of the prophets are standing at a distance in verse 7. The 50 men of the sons of the prophets, they're standing at a distance and they're watching them. And Elijah takes his cloak and he folds it up and he smacks the water in verse 8. And the water of the Jordan River was parted from one side to the other until the two of them could go on dry ground, and they cross through that way. And when they get across the river, Elisha has one of the boldest requests in all of the Bible. Elijah says, "I'm getting ready to leave. The time is coming. I can sense that it's about to happen. Ask what I shall do for you before I am taken away from you." And Elisha says, "Please let there be a double portion of your spirit on me." Or to put it in common terminology, he's asking for a double portion of his power. And so if you're Superman, I want to be Superman times two. Give me that ability, is what Elisha is asking for here. Because he has big shoes to fill with Elijah. And Elijah says, basically, that's not for me to give. But the Lord will give that. And your proof of him giving that is if you see me going up, you know the Lord has done that for you. But if you don't see me, it's not done for you. And then we have this the famous story that everyone kind of knows 2 Kings chapter 2 for. Is it up now? Oh, great. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate that. And so then we have this story where Elijah goes up. He's going up in the chariot. And this fiery chariot comes down and it separates the two of them. And there's this whirlwind in verse 11. And we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about this. I'll just tell you simply what I believe here. I believe that Elijah went up in the chariot. I know a lot of people say he went up in the whirlwind and that's what it says. But my thought is, why would God send his vehicle of transportation down to the earth if it wasn't to take Elijah up? I believe he went up in the chariot in the whirlwind. And that doesn't really matter with the story, but what does matter is Elijah went into heaven, and that'll be important for the story here. So remember that. Elijah is taken into heaven in verse 11. And we have this verse in verse 12, which is fascinating to me. After Elijah leaves, Elisha is supposed to take his place, and there's a lot of criticism that follows him. And I think the reason why, one of the reasons why, is in verse 12. And so Elijah is taken up, and Elisha says this in verse 12. My father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw him no more. Now, first reading, what do you think that Elijah or Elisha is talking about when he says that? Probably the fiery chariot. He's talking about God. But I don't believe that's what he's talking about. Because this exact same statement shows up in chapter 13 of 2 Kings. Just flip away for 1 second to 2 Kings chapter 13. When Elisha is going to die, when he's about to die and he's on his deathbed, in 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 14, the Bible says, "Now when Elisha had fallen sick, and his illness was on him, and he was to die, Joash the king of Israel went down to him and wept before him, crying, 'My father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen.'" Word for word, the exact same thing. So what happens here, what's happening in 2 Kings chapter 2, is Elisha is acknowledging that Elijah was the power of Israel. The power of Israel was not in its military might. It wasn't in its armies. It was in the spiritual warriors that were fighting against idolatry for Israel. And Elisha realizes that. He sees, there goes the power of God. It's leaving now, and I'm taking that place. That's why he asked for a double portion of Elijah's spirit. He was now the spiritual warrior for Israel. He had taken that role. And so he says that. And then he picks up his cloak after that, and he goes across, and he has a couple of critics to deal with. This whole chapter has been filled with, I think, critics of Elisha really being the next prophet. There's already been evidence of that in the story. The sons of the prophets, whenever they come to him and they ask him, "Do you know that Elijah is going to be taken away from you today?" Well, of course, Elisha would know that. It's almost like the prophets are thinking that Elisha doesn't have some information that they've gotten, when Elisha is the closest one to Elijah. It would be like somebody coming to me and approaching me and saying, "Did you know that Joshua doesn't like flying on planes?" You mean my brother, Joshua? Joshua, my brother. Of course I know that my brother, Joshua, doesn't like flying on planes. I'm his brother. I'm his only brother. I know that fact about him. But there's skepticism around this relationship that Elisha and Elijah have in this chapter. And there's also a little bit of skepticism from Elisha himself. Whenever he takes up the cloak of Elijah that's left on the ground in verse 13, he goes back to the Jordan River. And he took the cloak of Elijah that had fallen and struck the water, saying, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" And then he struck the water, and the waters parted and from one side to the other, and Elisha went over. So Elisha still needs a little confirmation here. But he's able, through the power of God, to perform Elijah's miracle exactly. And so now he has a little bit of confirmation. He's seen Elijah go up into heaven. He's performed Elijah's miracle exactly. He knows that he's the next prophet of God. He knows that that's his role to take now. But there's still some skepticism from the sons of the prophets. In this next story, starting in verse 15. "Now the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho, they saw opposite them, and they said, 'The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha.' And so they come down, and they meet him, and they bow to the ground before him, and they say to him, 'Behold, now there are with your servants 50 strong men. Please let them go and seek your master. It may be that the Spirit of the Lord has caught him up and cast him upon some mountain or in some valley.'" So what they're saying is, and I don't know, maybe they saw from a distance Elijah going up into heaven, or maybe Elisha has relayed this information to him, but regardless, the story is Elijah has gone up into heaven. And the sons of the prophets seem to think, well, maybe he didn't go all the way. Maybe he just went partway up, but then he was thrown back down, and he's laying on some mountain or in some forest, and he's hurt and lost and injured, and we need to go find him. Or in other words, we need to confirm the story that you're telling us. We don't trust the story that Elisha is telling them. And so we need to make sure that your story checks out, that Elijah really is gone. And Elisha says, no. He says, you shall not send them. I'm the new prophet of God. I know what I'm talking about. No, you can't do that. But they press him, they urge him, until he was ashamed in verse 17. Until finally, and I might add reluctantly, he says, send. Go ahead, send. And so they sent out the 50 men, and for 3 days they sought him, but they didn't find him. And so they come back to Elisha while he's waiting at Jericho, and he says, did I not say to you, do not go? In other words, I know what I'm doing. What I say, I'm now the prophet of God, and what I have said is directly from God. It's the truth, and you need to take that as truth. But there's still skepticism here. And so Elisha goes, and he performs a miracle. And the waters that are there, they're bitter. And so somebody brings him a bowl of salt, and he throws the salt into the water, and it's clean, and it's healed. And in verse 22, the water was healed this day according to the word that Elisha spoke. And so that's the context, that's the background of this story that we get to. There's a lot of skepticism, there's a lot of criticism around Elisha being the prophet of God. And we get to the story, and here's how the story is often presented. There are some lads, or the ESV, the translation that I read from, says small boys. And so we've got some kids. I have kind of a blurry picture, but kind of like this. Good-looking kid. Nice kid. That's there. Just a small boy. And Elisha is walking past, and all that they're doing is this group of boys, they're just being a little disrespectful to Elisha. So sticking their tongue out at Elisha as he's walking by. They see a bald guy, and so they want to be a little disrespectful to him, so they stick their tongue out. They're just having some fun, like all little boys will sometimes do. Now, is there anyone in this room who would kill that boy for doing what that boy is doing right now? And if you raise your hand, I'm going to call 911. We would not do that. We would not kill that boy for doing what that boy is doing. And so the problem with the story is those boys were killed by bears for just being a little disrespectful. And not just cute cuddly bears, some two she-bears, female bears, who were more aggressive than male bears, that you don't want to get in the way of a female bear with her cub. That's the phrase that goes along. They're aggressive bears, and they come and they kill those boys for being disrespectful. Now, I would have trouble defending that story. But I don't think that I have to, because I don't believe that that's exactly what's going on here in this story. And so let's slow down a little bit and let's look at the text, and we're going to answer these three questions that often come up in this story that people have a hard time dealing with. Were these just little boys that didn't know what they're doing, just innocent little boys? Were they just being a little disrespectful, just sticking their tongue out? And were they killed by the bears? So let's slow down and let's answer these questions one at a time. The text says in verse 23, he, Elisha, went up there from Bethel, and while he was going on the way, the ESV says some small boys, other translations will say some young lads, came out of the city and jeered at him. Young lads, small boys. I know that sounds a lot like little children, and this doesn't always work. But in Bible study, it's sometimes helpful to find a word, what a word really means, to look at that word in other contexts, to see how it's used in other contexts. And so this exact word, small boys or young lads, how it's translated, is the same word that's used of Joseph at age 17. Same word that's used of Joseph at age 17. It's the same word that's used of Joshua whenever he was serving as Moses' lieutenant. He'd already been a warrior. He'd already led battles for Moses and for the people of Israel. Same word that's used of Joshua at that age. It's the same word that's used of Solomon whenever he becomes king, whenever he's praying to God in 1 Kings chapter 3. And he says, I'm but a young lad. I don't know how to go in and to come out. Same word that's used of Solomon when he's king. It's the same word used of David whenever he fights Goliath. And he's already proven himself to be a mighty man of valor. That's how people know David in 1 Samuel. He's a mighty man of valor because he's killed lions and bears. And he kills that Philistine. Same word that's used of David when he's at that age. And so the picture that we get here is not some... Here's the story that we like to see, or that's often presented. There's six or seven of the young Bethel boys. They're about 5 or 6 years old. And they're sitting there by the street, and they're playing with some sticks with each other. And they see Elisha walking past, and he's a bald guy. And one of them nudges the friend next to him and says, "Hey, look at that bald guy." And these four or five, 6-year-old boys come running behind him, and they say, go up, bald head. But it's a different picture when it's not 6-year-old boys. It's young men, teenagers, who could be coming after him. And I think a mob of them. It wasn't just a few of them. I think there was a mob here. Because notice the number of children or young men who are attacked by these bears. In verse 24, there were 42 of the boys who were attacked by these bears. So this was a mob coming out after Elisha. A mob of young men coming after him. And it's important to notice where they come from. I've said it a couple of times, but by name. These boys, these young men, they're from Bethel. Do you know what Bethel is? Bethel is the place of the birthplace of idolatry in Israel. It's where Jeroboam set up one of the golden calves for Israel to start worshiping instead of Jehovah God. This is an idolatrous city where these young men are coming from. A huge mob of them, who I believe is more than 42 young men coming after Elisha. And so let me ask you this. If I were telling you a story, and I said that I was in downtown Michigan with one of my friends, and I was walking down the street, and 42 young men came out of the dark part of downtown Michigan, and I stopped my story right there, would you assume that something good happened or something bad happened in that story? You would probably assume something bad happened. From the character of that place and from the amount of people there, there's nothing good that's going to come from that. And so these aren't just little boys that are coming out. This is a mob of men coming from an idolatrous city confronting the prophet of God. And look what they say. That leads us to our next point. Were they just being a little disrespectful? The first thing that they say in verse 23, they say, "Go up." Now, that wasn't just a phrase that was used in that time that everyone understood what that meant. Think about the context of the story so far. What would "go up" refer to in 2 Kings chapter 2? Elijah. Elijah went up. And so you have this story of this prophet who has gone up into heaven, and there's his successor now who's claiming that he went up into heaven, and there's this group, this mob of young men coming out of this idolatrous city, and they say, "Go up." You say Elijah went up, why don't you go up? Prove it. Prove that he went up. Go up. They're not just saying, "We don't want you here in Bethel, just leave." That they are mocking Elisha and Elijah and God and the story that Elisha is presenting about Elijah. And furthermore, after that, they're not just mocking that. They call him, "You bald head." Now, this could be a reference to him not having hair, but that would be the only reference to Elisha not having hair in the Bible. And I can't prove this, but there is some thought and some speculation that head can also be referred to as master. It's another way of referring to a master. And so what they're saying is, "You naked head, you person with no master anymore." They're mocking him for losing his master, which he just had to go through. So that would be synonymous with you losing a loved one, and you're at the funeral. And a mob shows up at the funeral, and they start making fun of you for not having your loved one anymore. Saying, "Oh, ha, they died, now you're alone." That's what's happening here. I think, to put it in a little context here, one of the cruelest pictures of the crucifixion in my mind is in Matthew 27, whenever Jesus is hanging on the cross. Let's look at that really quick. In Matthew 27... starting in verse 39, when Jesus is hanging on the cross, here's what happens to him. "Those who passed by him derided him, wagging their heads and saying, 'You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross.' And so also the chief priests and the scribes and the elders mocked him, saying, 'He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is a king of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.' And the robbers who were hanging there, crucified with him, also reviled him the same way." Jesus, when he's hanging on the cross, what's happening there? Is there are groups of people walking past him and they're saying, come on, Jesus. You said you could do it. Come down from the cross. Prove it. If you're the Son of God, come on, jump. Does that make you angry to think about that? That people were doing that to my and your Lord while he's on the cross, provoking him and mocking him in that way? It makes me angry to think about that. The reverse is happening here to Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 2. You said that you're a prophet of God. You said Elijah went up. Go on. Jump. Go up. Prove it. Elijah's gone. Go with him. If that really happened. And so the picture that's happening here is not just an innocent, oh, there's a bald guy. Let's make fun of him. There's a group of people, a mob, an organized mob of idolatrous young men coming out after this prophet and mocking him, mocking Elijah, and mocking God. That's a much different story than what often gets presented of some innocent children making fun of an old man. And so that leads us to our last point. And I'm going to suggest to you that there's nothing in the text that indicates that these young men were killed. Let's look again and see what happens here. The word that's used in verse 24 is two she-bears came out of the woods and tore 42 of the boys. Tore. Now, I understand that the Hebrew language and the English language are much different. But there were a number of times whenever I was younger, I can remember my dad telling me that if I didn't stop what I was going to do, he was going to tear me up. I remember him saying that. And I can promise you, I never ran to my mom thinking that my dad was going to kill me or was going to rip my arms out of socket or anything like that. I knew what that meant. I was going to be hurting if I didn't stop what I was doing. I was going to be torn up. The word that's actually used in the text here is they were tore up or mauled. And the word mauled, tore up, is not synonymous with murder. It doesn't mean murder. And so let's just think about it, just move through this story kind of logically here. Unless there was some kind of miraculous intervention that's not given to us in the text, other than the bears being come out of the woods. That's the only thing that's said. The bears came out of the woods after this curse was uttered in the name of the Lord. Unless there's some other miraculous intervention, two bears would have great difficulty killing and eating 42 young men. That's 21 young men apiece, right? So let's just assume here that the bears come wading out of the woods and they wade into this mob, who I assume is more than 42 people, because I don't think the bears had a 100% success rate in this attack. I assume there's more than 42 young men in this group. They wade into the group, and maybe the first of the young men are kind of slow, and so they get attacked, and the bear comes and he hits number one. Hits boy number one. And then boy number two. And three. And four. And five. And six. And seven. And eight. 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Now, if you got tired of me counting to 21, imagine how tired those bears would have been in that attack. Right? The bears attacking and killing 21 young men apiece would have been phenomenal. Now, I think that the bears could have a pretty good chance of going in and maybe biting and slashing away and injuring 42 or 21 apiece young men. I think that that's possible. But for the bears to kill and to eat 42 of these young boys, first of all, that's a lot to eat for a bear. But second, it just doesn't make sense logically to me that that is what happened there. The text doesn't say that they were killed. And now, I don't want to lead on like I'm saying that none of them died. It could very well be that one or two or more of them died in this attack. And I don't also want to give the impression that these bears came out of the woods and they just put the young boys or the young men over their knee and slapped them on the behind and sent them home crying to their mom. No, I think these boys were attacked in a bear attack, but they had earned the punishment that they got because they were mocking the God of heaven. And they were mocking his prophet, and they weren't respecting him like he should have been respected. And so they earned this bear attack, and they went home hurting after this, if they went home at all. That's a much different story than what gets presented by Bible skeptics. The skeptic who says that God is a cruel and capricious God who just flippantly sends animals to kill and eat small children for sticking their tongue out. It's a much different story. And so some applications for us from this story. Some things that I learned here. There are some things in the world that are funny. There are some things that happen that you can laugh at and that you can enjoy making fun of. But one thing that's not funny is idolatry. It's not funny to God. It's not funny to God's prophets. And it's not funny for us to laugh about. And even John, in his epistle in 1 John chapter 5, the last verse in 1 John chapter 5 says, "So my little children, flee from idols." It's a very real thing in the world even today. Idolatry. And we need to watch out because these young men, characterized from this evil city of Bethel, of this city of idolatry, were profaning the name of God because they didn't respect him. Instead, they chose to worship idols. And so they profaned God's name and they profaned the prophet's name. And then second and third, they go kind of hand in hand. God does not take being mocked lightly. And so we need to be careful about laughing about God. And I know that this happens. I've seen the videos. There are people that you can watch and that you can watch videos of and you can listen to who are Christian comedians. They're clean comedians. You can watch them and have a good time. It's wholesome comedy. But I've heard the jokes about Jesus walking on water, or Jesus rising from the dead, or performing some miracle, or God doing some other thing and getting some kind of enjoyment or some kind of comedic joy out of what God has done or what Jesus did on the earth. And I just want to warn you, you need to be careful when you're watching those kinds of things and sending them to your friends and getting some kind of comedic relief out of that. Because God does not take being mocked lightly. It's one thing to laugh at ourselves and to laugh at our foibles and laugh at our inconsistencies, which, you know, we are inconsistent people. We make mistakes sometimes, and we can joke and laugh about that, but you better not laugh at God, because God is holy. And he said, "I will be treated as holy." And if I learned anything from this story, God takes very seriously his honor and his holiness, and he will defend that. And so we as his people need to also defend that. And then ask also the last point this morning, and we'll be done. When you come across a story in the Bible that's difficult to deal with, or that you don't understand, or that is attacked by Bible skeptics, that doesn't mean that you have to abandon your faith in God. There could be a logical explanation for the story if you just sit down and look at what's really happening. And so don't always take word for word what a skeptic will tell you or what you've heard all of your life in a story. Look at the text and understand that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so he doesn't change. He has always been holy. He has always been loving. He has always been merciful. He's always been full of grace. He's always had steadfast love. He's always been a God of judgment. He's always been a God of wrath. And he has always been a God who will destroy wickedness. And that's what I see here in this story. In 2 Kings chapter 2, a holy God destroying wickedness. So, the bloody Bible. Preach the bloody Bible. There are some things, like I said, that are difficult to deal with in the Bible. But we don't have to lose our faith just because someone says that proves that God is cruel and evil. We can still keep trusting in God and who God says he is, regardless of stories like that, because I think, if anything, stories like this in 2 Kings 2 prove the nature of the God that I believe in and that I love and that loves me. That's the God that we serve, and he is not capricious or cruel in punishing wickedness when we see that in the Bible. So, that's the lesson this morning. Thank you all for your attention with that. There wasn't really anything that we went over, anything that was said that would point you to want to give your life to Christ this morning. I don't think that I said anything like that. But maybe you've already been thinking about that before we got here this morning. Maybe you've been thinking about giving your life to Christ and how you need to do that. Because Jesus did die for you. He died on the cross for your sins to be forgiven. And he said, if you deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me, you will be my disciple. To take up your cross means to die. And to die, we need to be baptized into Jesus' death. And so if you've been thinking about that, why are you waiting still today, this morning? Jesus is waiting for you to be baptized, to call him your Lord, and to give your life to him so that he can wash your sins away. Why are you waiting for that? If you need to be baptized this morning, you can do that this morning. Or if you need the prayers of the church here, if you've been having difficulties in your life, if you've fallen short, that's the reason. We've been studying prayer a lot recently as a church family here. Prayer is powerful, and prayer works. And so if you need the help of this church in any part of your life, or you need to give your life to Jesus this morning, please come forward and do that now and talk to me while we stand and sing.